Well, hello all, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, your favorite podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and today we are re-entering one of my favorite topics to get on my soapbox and get preachy about. Today we're going to do a deep dive on obscenity and free speech. Listeners of this show will recall not too long ago we looked at the prosecution of Eugene V. Debs, socialist candidate for president, jailed for having the temerity to oppose the draft in World War I. I really like the Debs episode, personally, because free speech is such a personally important issue for me. I'm extremely skeptical of any type of censorship, particularly by the government, but also by private companies. Understanding that the Constitution only puts limits on what the government can do to repress or censor speech, I still feel it promotes a more free, open, and liberal society when companies do not fiercely regulate or direct what can become part of the public discourse. In our hypercharged partisan society at the close of 2022, censorship almost always appears in the context of political speech. Some entity, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Meta or Instagram or the short-lived governmental disinformation board, is accused of suppressing the discussion on some matter of political importance. But this wasn't always the case. Historically, censorship and free speech issues grappled a lot with the idea of obscenity. Maybe in 2022, we've become so desensitized that nothing offends our collective delicate sensibilities anymore. But in the past, in what we think of as a more traditional time in our society, a more wholesome time, there was a real debate over the expression of certain ideas. This case takes us back to the explosion of free expression that we call the 1960s. A war was raging. The same war, I think, is raging today, albeit on a slightly different front. It's the war against being offended. But in the 1960s, obscenity laws moderated what people could say or print, and imposed potential criminal penalties for people who crossed the line into vulgarity or pornography. Pushing boundaries was dangerous and risky. The comedy industry, especially stand-up comedy, had always been known and has always been known for pushing those boundaries. In satirizing and critiquing society, comedians often voice uncomfortable truths or share observations which, at best, cause some cognitive dissonance, but are often graphic. There is little humor in the mundane, so comics tend to be edgy in their routines, to say and do the unexpected, and to turn the audience's expectations upside down. Now, there was one comic in the early and mid-1960s who became a household name for his unabashed, uncensored routines. This comic believed that his right to free expression was only limited by whether or not people would buy a ticket to see his show. He refused to moderate himself or to tame his act. He became the poster child for free speech and the right to say whatever you want in front of groups of people who are paying money for a ticket to hear it. On April 1st, 1964, this particular comic was performing at the Café Au Gogo in New York City. Four NYPD vice officers attended the show and recorded his routine. 2 days later, on April 3rd, 1964, the comic and the owner of the Café Au Gogo were arrested for obscenity. In a prosecution which forced a national conversation on the definition of obscenity and the ethics and morality of criminalizing speech offered to customers who were actually paying to hear it. This is the state of New York versus Lenny Bruce. Just as a quick disclaimer, this episode is about obscenity and speech which is considered to be too upsetting to be even considered legal. So there's going to be some profanity and graphic speech involved. If you're with children, or if you're someone who doesn't appreciate vulgar comedy, you may want to either return to this episode later when you don't have impressionable minds nearby, or sit this one out. I've said on this program many times in past episodes that free speech is one of my big issues. I'm very much in favor of robust discourse. I do not believe in deplatforming. I do not believe in shutting down speakers. And I do not support anyone's right not to be offended, because I simply don't think such a right exists. No one should be forced to listen to speech they don't agree with. But at the same time, no one should be able to prevent others from hearing speech that they want to listen to. If you're a college student and a speaker is coming to your school who you disagree with, you do not have to attend. You can protest the speaker, you can petition your school administration, and explain why you think that this person is morally, ethically, or politically distasteful. You can encourage other students not to attend or to boycott, but you should not be permitted to physically prevent a speaker from engaging with other people who may want to hear the speech. That goes for students at universities. It goes for political activists. It goes for government representatives, especially for government representatives, because they are constitutionally required not to abridge free speech or association. In 2022, platforms are available for the common man, which would have been unthinkable in the 1960s. Because of the internet, the average person can communicate thoughts and ideas with a large following without any trouble. You are listening right now to a criminal defense lawyer in New York City spout off on free speech issues through a magical electronic device, as opposed to packing into a cramped hall and seeing me stand up on a stage with a microphone. We enjoy an ability to make our speech known today without any necessary infrastructure. In addition to that, Supreme Court decisions have, over the past several decades, mostly been ruling in favor of freer speech and less restrictions. Now, before we dive into the life and prosecution of Lenny Bruce, there is one common misconception regarding free speech that we absolutely must clear up, because it has been shown to be problematic over and over and over again. If you're interested in First Amendment issues or free speech at all, you have heard people assert that appropriate regulations on free speech exist, and that's true. But you will hear people say, for example, that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Now, the thought behind this is that you can't say something in public which is likely to cause chaos and possibly injury. The problem is that this is completely false. That trope dates way back to an old Supreme Court case called United States v. Schenck. Not only is that phrase a misquotation of what Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes actually wrote, but Schenck itself has actually been overturned. Do not, I repeat, do not let anyone argue that meaningful and appropriate regulations of free speech are appropriate because you cannot legally yell fire in a crowded theater. There are plenty of valid and decent arguments for speech regulations. This is just not one of them. It is not the law. It has actually never been the law. And the appropriate test right now in 2022 is whether this speech incites imminent lawless activity. Yelling fire in a crowded theater does not fail that test. Okay, let's get on to Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce was not born Lenny Bruce. On October 13th, 1925, he was born Leonard Schneider in Mineola, New York. He became Lenny Bruce in 1947 when he legally changed his name. Growing up, Leonard Schneider, or Leonard Bruce, was not a great student. But growing up, he was known for his wit. He was sharp and smart, but school just wasn't important to him. His father, Myron, was a shoe clerk. His mother, Sally, was a stage performer and dancer. His parents divorced when he was around 10, and he saw very little of his father after that. He spent a lot of time with his mother. At 16 years old, Bruce joined the Navy. It was 1942. World War II was just underway. He served in Northern Africa, in Italy. And while in the armed forces, he would do comedy routines for his shipmates very frequently. He was very popular with the other enlisted men. Even at 19 and 20 years old, he had a keen sense of what people thought was funny, and he was willing to push boundaries to get a laugh. He offered a release and relief from some of the death and destruction that the crew members were seeing in Europe and Northern Africa. But in 1945, Bruce had a problem. He was doing a comedy routine, and he dressed in drag. His buddies found the routine hilarious. His commanding officers did not. Bruce was made to go see the ship's medical officer, who Bruce quickly convinced he was experiencing homosexual urges. Based on the medical officer's report, Bruce was dishonorably discharged from the Navy. Now, while not being upset to leave the Navy behind, Bruce was irked that he had been discharged dishonorably. And he successfully lobbied to have his status changed on the grounds that he hadn't actually broken any naval regulations. But despite being invited to leave the Navy, Bruce served in the Merchant Marine during the Korean War, largely working on transport boats. In 1951, after returning home, he married an exotic dancer named Honey Harlow. And they had a fairly difficult and tumultuous relationship, but it did last all the way until Bruce's death. Bruce wanted her to stop dancing, and they settled in Los Angeles in the early 50s after the Korean War, but it was difficult for Bruce to find steady work as a comedian, and he ended up taking whatever shows he could find there at whatever venues. He would later say it was at this point that he really came to his own as comedian Lenny Bruce. His act, which even he described as mediocre at the time, became revamped. He stopped inhibiting himself and started saying all the things he really wanted to, but was previously too nervous to say. He was working mostly in the burlesque show circuit at the time, which gave him the freedom to experiment with material which might have been a little too risque for the high society comedy clubs of the day. Towards the late 1950s, Bruce settled down in New York City and had hoped to make it as a comedian in one of the most difficult places in the country to do so. Being a successful comic in New York in the late 50s meant that you really had to do something to distinguish yourself from the thousands of other people trying to do the same thing. But Bruce was doing something that other people largely weren't. He was talking about taboo topics. He talked about sex. He talked about drugs, organized religion, capitalism, even homosexuality. He was so sharp and such a great communicator that people loved it. In the 1950s and 1960s, sex and drugs were not topics that were discussed in polite society. It was common for married couples not to even sleep in the same bed. Bruce talked about sex, about masturbation, about ejaculation, about anything and everything that came to his mind. A lot of his shows featured spontaneous, Lenny Bruce spouting off on whatever he felt like. But not everyone was thrilled about Lenny Bruce's graphic comedy routines. On October 4th, 1961, Bruce was arrested at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco when his routine included the use of the word cocksucker, and he made jokes about the use of the word cum, referring to ejaculation. He was charged in California with obscenity. This was the first of several arrests for the content of his comedy shows. But obscenity wasn't Bruce's only legal issue. He was arrested in Philadelphia a week prior to his San Francisco arrest for drug possession. He struggled with drug addiction his entire professional career. But for our purposes here today on this program, we want to talk about April 1964 at the Café Au Gogo in New York City. Very few professional comics have careers that span decades. The lean, hip, attractive Lenny Bruce of the 1950s had given way to a slightly overweight and less inspired comedian by the mid-1960s. Bruce had been commissioned at the end of March 1964 to do a week's worth of shows at the Café Au Gogo for $3,500 by the owners, Howard and Ellis Solomon. Bruce was supposed to speak for roughly an hour each night, and the venue held about 350 people. On March 31st, 1964, one of the patrons sitting close to the stage was a former CIA agent named Herbert Rue. At the time, Rue was working as a license inspector for New York City. Rue listened to Bruce's show in horror. He scribbled down words and phrases which he found particularly distasteful. He was incensed that Bruce would make the comment that Eleanor Roosevelt had the nicest tits of any first lady in office, and insinuate that most men are oversexed creatures willing to have a one-night stand with the chicken if the opportunity presented itself. Rue went home after the show and wrote up an official report, which he delivered the following day, April 1st, to Assistant District Attorney Richard Q., who worked for New York County District Attorney Frank Hogan. Hogan, after reading the report, sent four officers in plain clothes to the Café Au Gogo to hear Bruce's show that night. The officers recorded the show and typed up a transcript. That transcript was provided to a grand jury the following day, April 2nd. Bruce was indicted for a violation of New York Penal Code Section 1140-A, which prohibited obscene, indecent, immoral, and impure drams, plays, exhibitions, and entertainment which tend to the corruption of the morals of youth and others. On April 3rd, just before Bruce took the stage, he and Howard Solomon, owner of the Café Au Gogo, were placed under arrest. Bruce posted his bail, and the following day was back at the Café Au Gogo to perform his act. Bruce became a flashpoint in the entertainment industry. Allen Ginsberg, one of the most famous New Yorkers of the 1960s, formed the Emergency Committee Against the Harassment of Lenny Bruce. More than 80 entertainers and authors signed a petition protesting the prosecution of Bruce for obscenity. And these weren't nobodies. This was Paul Newman, Bob Dylan, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Norman Mailer, Susan Sontag, John Updike, James Baldwin, George Plimpton, Henry Miller, Joseph Heller, Gore Vidal, Woody Allen, and many more. Let's talk now about the players in the trial. Oddly enough, there was no jury. Instead, there was a panel of three judges: the Honorable J. Randall Creel, the Honorable John Murtaugh, and the Honorable Kenneth Phipps. Three stuffy old white men with very keen senses of decency. Judge Murtaugh was the judge in charge and acted most of the time as though his colleagues were not even really there or had no opinion worth considering. Lenny Bruce hired a man named Ephraim London, who came with his very young assistant, Martin Garbus. Garbus, as some of you may recall, was the lawyer who represented Stephen Donziger, another trial previously covered on this program. Ephraim London was a famous First Amendment lawyer at the time. He had tried over 250 cases on First Amendment issues, and he was the go-to guy for this type of case in 1964. He was eager to take on the case and firmly believed in free speech and Bruce's right to say whatever he wanted to. As we noted, the district attorney was Frank Hogan, and the assistant DA in charge of prosecuting Lenny Bruce was Richard Q, the man originally sought out by Inspector Rue. To say that Q was a true believer in this case would be a dramatic understatement. Q despised Lenny Bruce and everything Bruce stood for. He thought Bruce was a filthy lowlife. He had a puritanical view of morality and unabashedly felt that acts like Bruce's would corrupt and debase society. He saw absolutely nothing redeeming or artistic about Bruce's show. The trial began on June 16th, 1964, roughly 2.5 months after Bruce's arrest. Q's case was relatively simple. He put on Inspector Rue, as well as some of the plainclothes officers who had attended and heard and recorded Bruce's show. He then played the recording of the performance at issue as well. He also played other recordings of Bruce's performances on April 7th for the judges. As if the content of the routine was not explicit enough, Rue testified that while on stage, Bruce was stroking the microphone in a masturbatory gesture, an accusation which Bruce himself vehemently denied and claimed was not funny. The prosecution's case lasted just 3 days. The day after Q rested, Lenny Bruce was rushed to the hospital with pleurisy, which is an inflammation of the tissue that separates the lungs from the chest wall. The trial would be adjourned until June 30th, when Bruce was well enough to return to court. Since the prosecution had just ended its case, London moved to dismiss on the grounds that the prosecution had not established a prima facie case against Bruce. Let's talk for just a brief second about what this means in English. We've discussed previously at length on this program about trial administration, but let's do a quick healthy recap. The burden of proof is on the prosecution to prove each element of the charged crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant does not have to prove anything. There is no circumstance in which the burden of proof ever shifts to the defendant. If the defendant asserts an affirmative defense, then the defendant takes on the burden of production of evidence to establish the defense by a preponderance of the evidence, which simply means that it's more likely than not. This does not, I repeat, not shift the burden of proof. Those are different. So the prosecutor calls witnesses and introduces evidence in an attempt to prove the elements. Once they feel that they have proven the elements, the prosecution rests. Resting means that the prosecution feels that the judge or jury at that point has sufficient information to find the defendant guilty. In every trial where the defendant is represented by a competent attorney, once the prosecution rests, the defense attorney makes a motion orally to dismiss on the grounds that the prosecution has not established what's called a prima facie case. In plain English, what this means is that the defense attorney is arguing that even if all the evidence and testimony produced by the prosecutor was accepted as true, there is one or more elements that have not been established, and thus the charge or charges which remain unproven must be dismissed. Let's look at Ephraim London's particular argument. He claimed that the state of the law in 1964, set down by previous Supreme Court decisions, was that in order for speech to be considered obscene, it had to inspire lustful and lecherous thoughts. Bruce's routines had simply not done that. They may contain language that was graphic, but they were not intended to and did not, and the evidence had not borne out, that they excited people sexually. In essence, what London was saying was that the Supreme Court had mandated that an element of any obscenity crime was the inspiration of lustful and lecherous thoughts. And since there was no evidence presented that Bruce's routines specifically did that, Richard Q had not established a prima facie case, and thus the charges must be dismissed. Q naturally pushed back hard against this, and two of the three judges agreed with Q that the evidence was sufficient to make out the 1140A charge. Then it was London's turn to put on his evidence, his motion to dismiss having been denied. The defense relied heavily on expert testimony. London and Garbus called the following witnesses: Richard Gilman, a drama critic for Newsweek magazine; Dorothy Kilgallen, a columnist and television panelist who critiqued Broadway shows, theaters, and nightclub performers; Neil Hentoff, a Village Voice newspaper columnist; Alan Morrison, an editor of Ebony magazine; Daniel Dodson, professor of comparative literature at Columbia University; Jules Pfeiffer, a cartoonist; Herbert Gans, a sociologist; Forrest Johnson, a Presbyterian minister; and Jason Epstein, the vice president of Random House Books. The defense testimony argued that Bruce's comedy had societal merit, that he was providing a value through his honest satire of American culture. The goal was to convince the panel of judges that because Bruce was providing value and adding to a national discourse and conversation on race, on sexual orientation, on politics, etc., that it should not be considered obscenity. Now, I've done my best to steel man these arguments in my head. I've thought about how I would approach this case if I was Richard Q or if I was Ephraim London. What arguments would I make, and would they be any different than what was presented? If I'm Assistant DA Q, this is filthy obscenity, full stop. Bruce's routines lack any redeeming quality because the goal is to shock by being so vulgar, so egregiously graphically lewd, that there is simply no argument that he is satirizing society in some clever way. He is simply spewing out offensive line after offensive line, and it can certainly have the impact of corrupting youth or other people who might be susceptible to this particular content. I would also make the argument that by the mid-1960s, the country is changing. Bruce may be the spearhead, but it's clear that he and others who follow him or mimic him are having an effect on American society and culture. The placid and wholesome 1950s are over, and the 60s now represent a systematic repudiation of the culturally conservative Pleasantville values of the 1950s. If the 60s were rejecting the idea that polite society simply does not discuss vulgar topics, then Lenny Bruce was driving that forward like a freight train. Knowing that your panel of judges, specifically Judge Murtaugh, is an old-fashioned guy, I would appeal to his sense of nostalgia for a time when people were good and decent, when men had honor and morality meant something. I would argue that Lenny Bruce is a disease on society, that his brand of humor had no place in America because it's indecent, and extended exposure would lead people down a path to immorality. I think I would have argued the case along fairly similar lines as Richard Q did if I was working as a prosecutor then. A big part of trial work is knowing who you're arguing to. If that's a jury, you absolutely must pay attention in jury selection to get bits and pieces which hint at what a juror might be receptive to. If it's a panel of judges, then what do you think might resonate with them? London knew that he would be fighting an uphill battle with these judges. He knew that Judge Murtaugh was not going to easily accept the profanity used to critique American conservative society was a useful tool to drive much-needed discussions in America. So he, rightly in my estimation, knew that his word was not going to cut it. And he tried to find reputable experts to chime in and provide their opinions that what Lenny Bruce was saying and doing was actually art rather than just being vulgar. Now, this was a really smart move. It gave his argument some credibility and allowed him to get things out onto the record, which he otherwise would not have been able to argue. It established that it was not just Ephraim London arguing that Bruce was contributing to a larger national conversation, but well-respected people in the entertainment, journalism, publishing, and even religious fields also felt that there was something valuable about what Bruce was saying. One area where I think I probably would have diverged from what London argued, and perhaps this is just hindsight being 2020, was that he tried to reframe the charge itself. I understand why he wanted to do it. He was relying on the Supreme Court decision in Roth v. United States, which defined obscenity in terms which indicated that it must appeal to prurient interests. Obscenity had to attempt to arouse some sort of immoral sexual desire, which he brought out in his motion to dismiss for not establishing a prima facie case. He argued Bruce's routine may have contained dirty words and graphic depictions of sexual acts, but it did not explicitly sexually arouse, nor was it intended to do so. I don't necessarily think that this was the right strategy. These judges were more likely to fixate on what the penal code of New York was, and were not likely to invalidate the New York statute based on a perceived incongruity with the Roth case. Ultimately, I doubt that this was a significant factor when the dust settled, but I do think it was biting off a bit too much and making the argument a little more of a stretch than was strategically sound. But at the same time, London was a straight First Amendment lawyer. He wanted sweeping changes made. He wanted laws amended and edited. So I understand his tactics and to the extent that they fit with what he wanted to do on a more cultural level, I agree with him. I just think that maybe they were more in line with the way he wanted to influence the law itself rather than what was necessarily in the best interest of his client at that particular time. In 1964, the phrase, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech," did not have the same meaning as we understand it to today. As we close out 2022, it's hard to imagine a comedian today being put on trial for having a routine which people found to be offensive or obscene. Plenty of comedians today do exactly what Lenny Bruce was doing. They point out hypocrisies or eccentricities in society and mock them. They observe the world and comment on what they see, even if what they have chosen to observe is which first lady they found the most attractive. Obscenity has changed. I think this is largely due to the internet and the amazing way that information, books, pictures, videos, soundbites, etc. are all now immediately available. Access has become nearly universal. Today, you don't need to pull your coat collar high and your hat brim low to conceal your identity as you sneak into a dirty bookstore. Now you can just open your laptop in the privacy of your bedroom and view whatever you want to. Views on obscenity seem to be constantly shifting. Also, television shows geared for middle and high school kids used to think showing two fully clothed teenagers kissing each other was a big deal. I remember the old show Saved by the Bell in the 90s had an episode which referenced a marijuana cigarette. And at the conclusion of the episode, the cast had a full public service announcement on the mature themes of the program. Now, primetime television shows routinely show kids doing drugs, having sex, and doing all manner of things which would have the pearl-clutching social conservatives of the 1950s fainting or hyperventilating. The point is that social mores change. What society views as obscene one day may be tolerated by a culture which now bestows upon itself the title of enlightened the following day. But obscenity and morality are a small part of the point when it comes to the prosecution of Lenny Bruce. Bruce was convicted. He was sentenced to 4 months in a workhouse, which was a legitimate punishment back then. It broke him. He spiraled into depression. He researched appellate work on his own. He went bankrupt in 1965, unable to perform and make any money. He ultimately died of a drug overdose in 1966. The thing about obscenity is, what is obscene is a matter of personal taste and morality. It is impossible to legislate matters which vary by taste. What I find to be immoral may not bother you at all, and what you find obscene, I may find artistic beauty in. Legislation which creates broad prohibitions based on vague notions of what's obscene, what may corrupt, what may incite to lecherous behavior, all of that is completely unworkable in any sort of real legal framework and practice. The real issue here is not whether Lenny Bruce's comedy was obscene. Plenty of people have rightly felt that it was, while many others felt that it was artistic and not obscene. No, the real issue is whether the state can restrict speech which it deems obscene. I certainly do not believe the statute which Lenny Bruce was prosecuted under is even remotely appropriate given the protections of the First Amendment applied through the 14th Amendment. When the 14th Amendment was passed, the prohibitions of Congress making laws which restricted speech was imbued also to the states. Meaning, the New York State legislature was at the time prohibited from infringing the right to free speech as well. The statute, which Frank Hogan's office used to prosecute Lenny Bruce, did just that. Free speech may be obscene. It may make you uncomfortable. It may force you to confront ideas which you do not hold, and it may result in you having to reevaluate positions which you were once sure of. When confronted with this type of speech, you have options. You can either choose to remove yourself from the situation, i.e., you can choose not to listen. No one should be able to compel you to hear speech, but alternatively, you can voice your own speech either in agreement or disagreement and engage in healthy debate or discussion. But what the state cannot do, and what I believe private organizations such as colleges, businesses, etc., should not do, is make speech illegal or suppress or censor it. Before everyone listening gets up in arms, I recognize that there are limitations to free speech. I get it. Even someone as enthusiastic about free speech as myself recognizes that there are these particular legal limits. Currently, the limit is incitement to imminent lawless action. I understand that because speech which directly and necessarily leads to a violation of another's rights can be rightly prohibited, in my view. That being said, if the speech simply offends you, hurts your feelings, or espouses a worldview which you disagree with, the government should have no say in whether that person is free to voice that opinion. just as the government should have no authority to silence your opinion. Cracking jokes about masturbation, calling capitalism hypocritical, making observations about the sexual nature of young men should absolutely be considered protected speech, whether it holds what you consider to be artistic value or not. I don't think I'm likely to get much disagreement there. I think most people would agree that the comedy of Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Eddie Murphy, Bob Saget, and many others who push boundaries and say offensive things is fine for people who want to listen and hear it. I don't think many of us could even picture today police arresting a comic for the content of his or her routine. It's an absurd notion. And you know what? It should be. But that's not to say that the United States has really settled in on free speech and on obscenity. Interestingly, prohibitions on obscenity still abound. It still sparks protest, and actions are taken to prevent obscene speech by huge companies very frequently. But it's no longer dick jokes or Eleanor Roosevelt's figure that we find obscene. It's political views that we don't support. There are many efforts from all over the poorly devised political spectrum, which seek to prevent the views of opponents from being publicly proclaimed. In a nutshell, this is wrong and dangerous. Somehow, a good number of us have got it into our heads that if we can just prevent other people from saying what they believe, that everyone will just come to our side and we will have a perfect peace and harmony. That's complete nonsense. Now again, I recognize that the state itself is prohibited from legislating in ways that prevent the free and open proclamation of political speech. But that private companies, i.e. Twitter, Meta, Facebook, Instagram, Mastodon, etc., are free to run their companies however they want. And they should. I do not support the right of either the government or the people to dictate how corporate entities act. That's up to the company. If Twitter, under Elon Musk, decides to ban progressives or neoconservative accounts, well, so be it. That's his right as the owner of the company. I think he shouldn't, but I wouldn't say that he couldn't. And if he did, I think people would start to leave Twitter, and that would hurt his company and any potential profits derived from it or from advertising revenue. So I would say it's not really in his best interest to target speech for censorship. But again, he's free to do what he wishes. In this one lawyer's humble opinion, too many people in our modern times are too comfortable with banning wrong think and wrong speech. The same thing that was done to Lenny Bruce is still attempted today. The players are different, but the theory is the same. The idea is that certain ideas are so wrong that society needs to be protected from them. Whether the guardian is the state or Facebook, it doesn't matter. The outcome is the same. I cannot get on board with supporting protection. I don't believe anyone has a right not to be offended. I don't think it's healthy to live your life in such a bubble that you're never confronted with challenging ideas. If you hold certain thoughts and beliefs and you engage in a debate and are unable to defend those ideas, then perhaps you should rethink how strongly you hold them, rather than try and silence your opponent. Often, the people who are pushing the hardest to keep people quiet are the ones who are the loudest about how they are seeking to protect other people's rights. Everyone wants to think that they're the ones doing the right thing, and people come up with all sorts of justifications about why certain people must be deplatformed. They will say that they're normalizing violence, that it's hate speech, that it's fascism or Nazism, authoritarianism, or some other ism, which it typically isn't. Tolerance especially tolerance for speech, does come with certain elements which are at times difficult to digest. It means you have to defend the rights of people who say things you disagree with, that you find offensive, that you may even find perverse. It means that when Nazis want to hold a rally, you have to grit your teeth and say, well, they have a right to say what they want. Or when the Communist Party of Arizona wants to hold a rally to support their candidate, and it's replete with speeches invoking Marx and Lenin or whoever else, you have to support their right to do so. What I think causes a lot of people to struggle with this concept is that defending someone's right to say something is not an adoption of the content of their speech. I believe freedom of speech means the right of people to express ideas that I do not agree with. I believe I have the right to express ideas that you don't agree with, and vice versa. I believe Lenny Bruce had a right to appear on stage and crack jokes that people may find offensive. I also believe there was not a single person there that was kept there against their will and forced to listen. The trade-off for free speech is hate speech. It's vitriol, resentment, bigotry, racism, xenophobia, lies, and all manner of things which we should collectively abhor. But toleration of these things is absolutely necessary for a society which values the free exchange of speech and expression. Protectionism doesn't work because taking away someone's ability to make speech is the least effective way to change anyone's mind. It entrenches people who feel martyred as opposed to changing their mind. It causes people to feel, sometimes appropriately, that because their opponents can't win in a debate, they're just resorting to silencing. Coercion is a poor tool for convincing anyone of anything. People need to be able to make up their own minds, and will typically only change them if convinced that another option is more correct than their currently held belief. Deplatforming someone is not an effective way to accomplish that. In summation, it's easy for Americans to believe that we all support free speech. It's a trope we parrot. But I think we need to look at ourselves individually, really scrutinize ourselves, and really ask whether that's true. As a Jew, do I support the rights of neo-Nazis to march through Skokie, Illinois, a traditionally Jewish neighborhood? Unquestionably, yes, I do. I find their ideology abhorrent. Their rhetoric is disgusting and their goals are antithetical to what I believe this country was founded on. But in my estimation, it is far more dangerous to censor views I don't agree with than to present my arguments explaining why I disagree with them. Someday, I may find my own views to be out of vogue, and I certainly don't want people telling me that I can't say what I want because it offends someone. I don't mind people disagreeing with me. Many of you listeners have voiced such disagreements with me, and I think you would all agree, or at least I hope you would, that we've been able to have lively debate on it in a civil and professional and courteous manner. I am always welcome to being shown that I'm wrong. And I believe I'm very fortunate to have an open-minded audience who likes to engage with me. Now, we have come a long way on free speech. I'm proud of how far we've come as a country towards recognizing free speech. I still think there's a ways to go, but in terms of government criminalizing speech, I think that the days of imprisoning Eugene Debs or Lenny Bruce for what they say on stage in the rearview mirror is a good thing. Is there more work to be done? Absolutely. But are people generally more accepting of speech now than they have historically been? In general, I think so. I think we tend to see some loud voices at the political margins and ascribe more power to their movements than they have. Free speech cases do still pop up. You know, recently there was the girl who was kicked off her high school cheerleading team for posting a video online of her saying fuck cheerleading while off campus. A whole lawsuit evolved over whether a public high school could take action against her for speech made off campus. But I'm far more accepting those types of grapples than I am with having to confront criminal codes or penal codes which specifically target speech and impose jail or workhouse penalties for it. To me, even these debates show progress. If you take nothing else away from this episode, then I want to leave you with this. Before you join a Twitter mob or campus protest against a speaker you find offensive, vile, or obscene, take a moment to ask yourself what your goals are. Do you want to simply remove the ability for a certain person to reach a large group of people? Are you trying to prevent a certain idea from reaching that group? Why is it so important that this person not be permitted to speak? If their ideas are so bad, why do people follow them? Are people more likely to abandon those bad ideas if the speaker is shouted down, or if someone debated them and presented reasons why they disagree? Be the person who engages in debate. Shine sunlight down on bad ideas and make it clear why they shouldn't be followed. Uphold people's rights to say what they want, while at the same time, be a force for a more decent and civil discourse on difficult topics. But always, support the freedoms that we take for granted in America, but which are denied to so many people in so many other places. So that's the show on Lenny Bruce, obscenity, free speech, and the current state of our democracy. Thank you, Dan Townsend, who edited today's program. Thank you, listeners, for your support of In Summation. I always appreciate the insightful comments I get and the discussions that they generate. Again, I hope to have some guests on soon, so I hope people can get excited for that. Some very interesting cases with some good legal issues to dig into coming soon, I promise. If you want to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or a case, if you just want to ask a question about criminal law, or you want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can view the show's website, insummation.com. Check out the show's Facebook page, or do it the old-fashioned way and look me up at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. I really do appreciate all the thoughtful messages that I get and the discussions that they generate, and I do try to be very good about responding. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. If you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out the entire catalog. I hope you'll enjoy it. As always, thanks for stopping by. And I hope that you'll come back for more.